Okay, so thanks a lot to the organizers who've put together this really very exciting meeting. I can't remember the last time I heard so many new experimental results. So today I'll tell you a couple of different things, one of which is kind of on the archive, another thing which is very new in collaboration with Philip's group. Of course, all of this started with this beautiful set of experiments and very quickly confirmed. So part of my talk will be about these bilayer graphene, monolayer of graphene on another monolayer. But the second part about the superconductivity will be on a slightly different system, the pairs of bilayers twisted at a certain angle. Okay, so so just to sort of set the stage for sort of a contrast that will kind of appear several times during my talk, of course, we're interested in correlation phenomena in electronic systems, and they really fall into two different categories, if you like. People have studied what happens in Landau levels, where the kinetic energy is quenched by a magnetic field, interactions are dominant, and we get all the beautiful physics of the quantum Hall effect. The other limit is in correlated materials, oxides, the copper oxides being the most famous example, where you have electronic states that where the hopping between these orbitals is reduced, is small compared to the interaction energy. So you have nearly localized orbitals that then hop between these sites, and you have the interaction energy. Sort of a paradigm of that is the Hubbard model. And the question, of course, we have is these new materials that have been discovered, these Moiré materials, to collectively call them that, where exactly do they lie? Should we think of them more like this, where you have bands which have a certain topological character being partially filled, or should we think of them more like these Hubbard model kind of physics? What I'll try to argue, and you'll see in the first part of the talk, that even in these Moiré materials, at least in certain cases, the bands do have some kind of topological character. There'll be more talks regarding that tomorrow. That may be important for some of the physics. There'll also be things that are closer to the quantum Hall effect, bands with Chern number that often appear. This sort of represents some new intermediate sort of physics, where we'll try to do, both use tools from this limit as well as from what we've learned from things like Hubbard models and the analysis of, correlated models like that. Okay, so just to give you a rough idea of the scales, we're talking about an effective lattice of orders of tens of nanometers, significantly larger than what you have on the atomic scale, and this is sort of the typical interaction energy, about 30 millielectron volts, sort of like room temperature kind of energy scales for the interaction.
Ashwin, where is that number coming from? Why 30 MeV?
So take this particular length scale, evaluate the Coulomb interaction at that length scale.
This curve at kappa, this length scale,
right,
and kappa is boron nitride.
Yeah, boron nitride, yeah. Okay, so there are two parts to my talk. The first one will be about essentially one electron physics, but investigating this origin of these magic angles. Is this the real question that we want to address? Is this a problem of engineering? You have a parameter, you have this angle. By suitably choosing that, maybe you can try to reduce the bandwidth of these electrons, and then you can enhance the correlation effects. And in that case, we probably wouldn't call it a magic angle. There seems to be something more going on with that. And we'll try to dig a little deeper and see if there's some interesting structure there that you can really associate with this magic angle phenomenon. That'll be sort of the first part. The second part is extremely new, and maybe I shouldn't even be talking about it today. It's sort of in progress. But one of the key questions all of us had when Pablo's experiments came out is really, what is the nature of this correlated insulator? Okay, so we know in the Coupe rates, the first approximation, you can think of the insulator as an antiferromagnet. We know in the Coupe rates, the superconductor is a D-wave spin singlet superconductor. What is the analogous sort of information over here, you know, aside from things like the mechanism and, you know, more philosophical questions, just in terms of symmetric breaking or things like that? What is the nature of this correlated insulator and the superconductor? And we were, of course, it's still an open question in the case of the monolayer on monolayer graphene. But I'll argue that maybe in this double bilayer graphene that Philip talked about yesterday, we have some further insight, and we can sort of give at least a tentative answer, a proposal for what these two are that seems to agree with experiments and with some simple theory. Okay, so let me start with that. This is the first part is done with Alex and Grisha. Grisha is actually a high energy physicist, but I managed to get him interested in this problem. You'll see in a minute how. Yeah, so we want to study this problem that Adam kind of introduced in the first talk. You have this pair of graphene sheets. Each of them is described by a graphene Dirac Hamiltonian. And then there's a coupling between the layers that depends, of course, on this relative twist angle. Okay, so the coupling between the layers looks like that. It's essentially a hopping, takes the electrons between the layers. It can be within the same sublattice, the AA and the BB sublattice. That's one parameter, W0, and there is a coupling between the opposite sublattices, W1. And at least in this simple model that was written down, there's a precise form for this U. It involves these different wave vectors. It's a complex number for every position. And in addition, these two numbers, W0 and W1, were set equal to 1 naught. Okay, so effectively, this problem has a single dimensionless constant. These two are set equal to W, divided by essentially the angle in the limit of small angles, times the separation between the Dirac points and VF. Okay, so this ratio, you can sort of study the problem as a function of this ratio. And it sort of reduces to the simple, you know, kind of setup. Essentially, this is the inverse of the angle. That's the thing that you can easily tune. Okay, so what was found there was, you know, these kind of band structures. These are the special angles, if you like, where the velocity, the effective Dirac velocity vanishes. That was used as a criterion to determine these special magic angles. Okay, and in the first case, at least, you get a very flat band, and most of the you know, experimental study is focused around that first angle. Okay, so this criterion, which is a relatively innocuous criterion, one particular parameter vanishes as you tune the angle, actually leads to something more in this particular case, not just that point, but the entire band becomes very flat. Okay, not perfectly flat, but relatively flat. This doesn't necessarily happen for the higher magic angles where the velocity vanishes, but you still have significant bandwidth. Okay, so one might have asked maybe a better definition of these magic angles, and a different definition is a more comprehensive kind of criterion for flatness. That may end up giving you a different sequence. Another question that may be important is whether these bands are actually isolated from the rest of the spectrum. Yes, so if you want to do some correlated physics and just focus on these bands, you'd like the other ones somewhat removed. In fact, in experiments, these are seen to be relatively isolated and more than you would expect from this particular model. And I think we understand that better now. It has to do with the effects that were neglected in the simple initial model, lattice relaxation, which ends up moving away these other bands. Okay, so there seem to be several different criteria, you know, for a magic angle or for the optimal angle at which you might see some interesting physics. Okay, so what we hope to do was to find a different model, let's say, or a deformation of this model, where all of these different criteria kind of come together. And you would have sort of a unique definition of what would be a special angle. And one thing we tried was to go back to this original model and play a little bit with this coupling matrix that couples the two layers. Yeah, so like I said before, there are these couplings between the AA and the BB sites. Let's just think of switching them off for a moment and work with this model, which still just has one parameter. It's just the parameter of hopping between the A and B sites of this Moiré pattern. Okay, so we'll come back to whether this model is realistic or how realistic it is. But let me just think of it as a mathematical model for a moment, and you'll see that it does give you some significant insight. Okay, so you can rewrite this Hamiltonian in this form. So there's this Dirac operator, and these derivatives over here are, the derivative with respect to this complex coordinate. And in fact, if you start at this equation, you can convince yourself that this looks like Dirac fermions moving in a background, and the background is actually a non-abelian gauge potential, an SU2 gauge potential. Of course, that's static. It's just defined by this Moiré pattern. But it reduces to a problem of these Dirac fermions just moving in this SU2 gauge background. And of course, at this point, I think Grisha got excited by this problem, something that he's familiar with. And in fact, this was also noticed a while back by Paco Guinea's group, that there's this mapping between these two problems. Okay, so once you have it in this form, it turns out there's a special symmetry that we can exploit. It's a chiral symmetry. There's a fixed matrix that anti-commutes with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so all the energy levels in this problem will be particle hole symmetric, and you can find the particle hole conjugate simply by multiplying by a particular matrix. Okay, so this will turn out to be very useful. Okay, and now let's go back and recalculate the band structure just with this parameter switched off. Okay, so we can start with a big angle. So this alpha being small corresponds to an angle that's bigger than the magic angle. And you see these bands. This is the band that will eventually become the flat band, but there are also these other bands there. And to begin with, of course, there's significant dispersion. It's not particularly flat. Okay, so let me run this movie as we reduce the angle and approach this magic angle. Okay, so you see this bandwidth goes down, and it's well isolated, and exactly at that point, it becomes flat. Okay, in fact, we can show, and I'll show you in a minute, that it's perfectly flat. Okay, there's absolutely no dispersion. And then you proceed, you go to smaller angles, and then there's a recurrence of that phenomenon. Okay, these bands get flat. Once again, perfectly flat, and you get a sequence of angles where these bands are exactly flat. Okay, so we'd like to understand that better, and this model actually allows you to get some analytic handle and really prove that you get this perfectly flat band at some particular angle. Okay, so just to contrast these two, this is our chiral model where we switched off this potential. And this was the original model. And you see that these are, in the case of the first magic angle, they're both very flat. This is perfectly flat, if you like. But in addition, you have these big gaps separating the band from everything else. And this is the second magic angle. Again, it's very flat. And in fact, these two differ from one another. Okay, so we have a different prediction for the second magic angle, at least in this model, and so on. And in this particular case, all three definitions of what a magic angle is, the flatness of the band, the vanishing of the Dirac velocity, and the band gap, all of them line up at the same angles. Okay, so it's sort of unambiguous what is the magic angle in this case. Okay, so now let me tell you a little bit, of how we can show this band is exactly flat, and it has some nice mathematics, I think. We don't really know the full significance of this. Okay, but you start with this band structure, which is, let's say, away from the magic angle, and you have these particular states which are exactly at zero energy. Okay, so that comes from this chiral symmetry. If you're exactly at the K points of this mini Brillouin zone, there's something like an index theorem that tells you there's got to be a zero mode. Okay, and so this it satisfies this particular equation. There are these derivatives acting on these block wave functions, and this potential, this SU2 gauge field kind of thing, that has to be zero in order to get a zero energy solution. So you always guaranteed these solutions at these particular K points. Okay, so the real question is, can you sort of transport these solutions and make them appear at all points in the Brillouin zone? Okay, so if you can do that, you'll get a perfectly flat band. Okay, so at first sight, it seems that you can actually do this very easily. Okay, so you have a solution to this equation. You can simply multiply the solution by any function of z, okay, the complex coordinate. And this, when these derivatives act on z, this is a derivative on z bar, it will simply go through this function, and it will act as it did before on this spinner. And it seems like from one zero mode, you can actually get many zero modes that can potentially be these, form this flat band. Okay, but it turns out that there is a problem with this naive argument. And the problem is you cannot get an analytic function that has the right periodicity properties. Okay, so if you want to have an analytic function that gives you a different crystal momentum, there's nothing that will do that, which is simply a function of z and have no poles. Okay, so you're forced to have poles. And if you allow for poles in this function, you can actually write down a ratio of these two. These are theta functions. You can arrange them to have exactly the right periodicity property. So that if you give me one zero mode, you'll be able to get zero modes over the entire Brillouin zone. Okay, but of course, this introduces a different problem, which is now these functions are not normalizable in general, because you have this function over here. It goes to zero at some point in the Brillouin zone. It'll blow up, and this solution will no longer be a normalizable solution.
Can you tell us what that notation means
exactly? Yeah, it's this.
Oh.
Yeah, write it down quickly. So I'll. So you see, these theta functions have something that looks like a periodicity property, but not if you shift it in the other direction. Okay, so you get these phase factors, but you also get a function of z. In order to cancel this function of z, you need to divide by a different theta function. Yeah, and that'll really make it something like a crystal momentum. Okay, so how do you solve this? You can solve it if the location of the zero of this denominator coincides with the zero of the wave function. Okay, so if this wave function in real space vanishes at some point, you can align those zeros together, and you can get a function that is normalizable. So eventually, this question about the flat band can be reduced to a question of when this particular wave function, the zero mode wave function at a particular point in k-space, has a root. And it turns out that you can solve that problem. These wave functions can only vanish at some particular points in this Brillouin zone. I think it's this yellow point in the unit cell, sorry. And in general, the wave function at this point is a single real number. As you change a parameter, like the angle, that real number could change sign. And if it changes sign, there's a zero in between, and those fix the magic angle. Okay, so in this way of thinking about it, you get a perfectly flat band by tuning a single parameter. Okay, of course. Yeah.
Do you expect this exactly flat band even you have lattice distortion?
Like yes. Yes, I'll get to lattice distortion. In fact, our model is sort of an extremely distorted lattice limit of that problem. So this is specific to our particular model, where we switched off one of the couplings. And you'll see that lattice distortion takes you in that direction. Okay, so anyway, so this is sort of the math behind this magic angle. But now you can ask, is it relevant to the actual system, or how relevant is it to the actual system? So it turns out it's more relevant than you might think. So initially we had this model where both parameters were the same, W0 and W1. We are in this extreme limit where we've switched off one of the parameters. But if you take into account lattice relaxation, which was just mentioned, there's a very physical argument that tells you the effect of lattice relaxation is to reduce this number. Okay, so the lattice actually likes the stacking where the A and B are on top of each other. It reminds it of Bernal stacked graphene. That's the energetically stable structure. So general lattice relaxation will tend to shrink these AA and BB regions and expand the AB. Okay, and the effect, if you want to kind of capture it in a single parameter, the effect is to reduce this W naught. Okay, so in fact, that was done in these papers by Cushino, Liang Fu, and Yuan. where they fit the relaxed structure to a particular set of parameters. And I think this one is roughly 80% of the initial equal value. Okay, so this also helps you get these band gaps. Okay, so this relaxation is very important, and it's pushing the model in the parameter toward the parameters that we are, we would like to see. Okay, so this is just a picture showing you the AA and BB sides and the AB sides of this Moiré pattern. And as you can see, this AB sides, they really look like Bernal-Stapp graphene. It's not perfect in this picture because they're rather large angle. And those sides, those regions will expand under lattice relaxation. Okay, so so if you do this, you can make a plot between this ratio of couplings being 0, which is our ideal model, ratio of couplings being 1, which was the initial model proposed, and reality is somewhere in between. Okay, and at least for the first magic angle, what happens is that there's sort of a smooth evolution. Okay, so if you look at the band gap closes if you're at this extreme point, but then any amount of relaxation opens a gap, and of course the gap is maximized as you approach the this chiral limit.
So it's okay. Gap to the higher bands.
The higher bands, yeah.
And the blue curve is what?
Blue curve is for the second magic angle. Okay, so we predict second magic angle, which is a quarter of a degree. It's a different prediction from the original model. And here, actually, this lattice relaxation, if you make this plot, there is some significant change between the chiral model and the eventual W equal to 1 model. Okay, so there's some additional stability of the first magic angle that's not shared by the second one. Okay, but on the other hand, over here for smaller angles, as you go to these smaller angles, you actually expect a larger lattice relaxation. Okay, so you saw in Dimitri's talk, if you go to very small angles, in fact, there's an enormous lattice relaxation. You get these domain walls. Okay, so although there is more of an effect, you expect to be closer, and the hope is that at least some of these higher magic angles, the model that you get is literally what is seen experimentally. Okay, but at this point, I think what it helps us do is it gives us a clear criterion for these magic angles. If you give me a model and you see a regime where the bands are relatively flat, what I would try to do is to pull it back to one of these chirally symmetric models, and there you can demand that the band is exactly flat. Okay, you don't need to compromise at all. You can get the perfectly flat band. And those bands have interesting wave functions, as we saw. The wave functions are related to these theta functions, which I didn't actually go into detail, but those same functions appear when you talk about the Landau levels on a torus. Okay, so it has some interesting connection to these to the physics of Landau levels, and maybe that's a good point to sort of set up your problem and expand about. Okay, so there is some insight, but I think there's more work to be done really understanding the origin of these magic angles, even in this chiral model. Okay, so one thing we observed, which we don't have an explanation for, is that the sequence of these alphas, as you go to larger alpha, they differ by 1.5. Okay, so the first few are, this is 0.5, then it is close to 3, and 2.2, and then later on the separation is exactly 1.5. It smells like the roots of some Bessel function or something, right? But we are not able to actually have a theory which gives us that conclusion. Okay, so there are many things like this, nice properties of this model that we don't actually understand.
Is there a connection between the mechanism of magic angle here and what Tim was talking about, the change of the character between balance and?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Can you repeat the question?
So the question was. Earlier, the first half of the morning, Tim was showing us at the magic angle the character of the balance and conduction band were switching. He plotted.
It is the same. Yeah. It's so a band crossing only happens at the same time throughout the entire band. The gamma point crosses zero, the end point crosses at the same time with alpha and everything. I think that's another possible explanation which is consistent with all these.
Yeah, but I think in some sense there has to be some element of that because just the quantum numbers track each other. There's a reflection quantum number that just goes through.
So the question is whether you know the connection.
Yeah, okay, it would be nice to, offhand I don't, but that's a good suggestion, yeah.
Tim's talk, there's also no second magic angle. So
there was a dip.
Yeah, so you know, the second magic angle is if you have this W equal to zero model, W zero equal to zero model, there is a second magic angle.
Yeah.
Right. Now the question is, where does the relaxed structure, where does it lie? And if it's within this range, then it's clearly connected to that physics. If it's beyond that, you know, then it's probably not relevant. Liang.
Just to confirm, when you restore A coupling, there's still a flat band at certain.
No, it's not perfectly flat. I mean, flat in the sense of mathematically flat. No, but it's the bandwidth is relatively small. Yeah.
But you still can define the minimals of bandwidths as
yes.
a function of the angle.
That's right. Yeah. But you know, then you're not sure if that minima that you get, is it related to a magic phenomenon or is it an engineering thing, right? Here, if it's absolutely flat, it's not engineering. It's, with one parameter, you can't engineer completely flat. But, yeah.
So you only get a gap if W0 is different than W1. If they're equal,
yes.
You never get a gap.
Well, at least for this, I don't know how strongly you should say that, but it's certainly true in this model that it seems to be exactly at that point. So, but as soon as you begin to reduce it, you get a gap at the first magic angle. And that's another criterion you could use from the experimentally measured gap. I think it's around 0.3. You can kind of read off it's something like this is sort of the relaxation. Okay, so actually, how much time do I have?
You started at noon.
Okay, I have lots of time.
After all the issues we had, I don't know whether I should subtract that time for being under
pressure. add the time, I would say, yes. Okay, so this is things that you heard a little bit last time in Philip's talk, and we had a lot of fun collaborating with Philip's group. The theory is done by Jong Yoon, who's a student at Harvard, and Islam, who's a postdoc. So this is really asking the question, what is the nature of these the mod states, the mod state that you see in these materials, and the superconducting state? Okay, and we had various speculations for the monolayer and monolayer graphene, but somehow it may be that this particular system is a little easier to talk about because of certain things that are observed in the experiments. Okay, so just an analogy with this twisted monolayer. Twisted bilayer graphene, two single layers that are put on top of each other and twisted, you can do something analogous by taking bilayer graphene on top of bilayer graphene and twisting them. Okay, actually, that comes in two varieties. The thing we're going to look at is the so-called AB on AB graphene, which is the natural if you cut and put this on top of something else. Okay, so again, you have something like this magic angle phenomenon. But the relevant dispersion that enters over here is not the Dirac dispersion. Idealized, it's this quadratic band touching, which then gets reconstructed by this magic angle phenomenon. And an additional knob that you have over here, which you don't really have, not useful in the case of the monolayer graphene, is that you can apply a vertical electric field, displacement field D, and you can use this to tune the bandwidth and additionally look for flat bands. Okay, it turns out this will be important for us. If you didn't have this knob, you wouldn't really be seeing very interesting phenomena in this.
The theory calculations for electric field in monomono, it also changes the band structure.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But does it?
Stuff.
Mm-hmm. But so there even...
The effect is not dramatic.
Right.
But it depends on the devices. We have some devices where effect happens. So
Okay, maybe I should rephrase what I said. Even without gating, this is an interesting system. You see that here you literally need the gate to make it interesting. Okay, so there's very nice initial work done by Yahui Zhang at MIT with Senthil and Yuan Kao and Pablo and Dan Ma. So they wrote down the first theory for this type of generalized twisted bilayer systems. They took a very simple model of the electronic dispersion. They threw away a bunch of effects and kept this dispersion, the quadratic dispersion, they ended up seeing this sort of magic angle phenomenon. As you tune the angle, the bandwidth achieves a minimum somewhere around 1 degree. And if you go and look at the band structure over there, you get some relatively narrow bands. So this bandwidth is, in millielectron volts. You get narrow bands where the conduction and valence bands are split off from one another. Okay, so this was very promising. So this would suggest that even without that the displacement field, you could get some correlated phenomena in this in these systems. Okay, now unfortunately, the reality is that you also have other terms in this Hamiltonian, the so-called trigonal warping term, that actually complicates the band structure significantly. You can sort of ignore it in some limits for just the Baylor graphene, but when you think about this Moiré problem, it ends up changing the band structure significantly. So for example, these two bands, conduction and valence band, get mixed. They sort of lie on top of each other, and the bandwidth is significantly enhanced. Okay, so basically bad things happen once you put in this trigonal warping. You also need to worry about this lattice relaxation. So we ended up doing some of the theory on this, prompted by Phillips measurements. And what you see is that this is the situation. If you don't have any displacement field, you have some relatively large bandwidth, and the bands are overlapping. You put on the displacement field, sufficiently large displacement field, and these bands separate out, and the bands get narrowed. Okay? And you can demand to know where in parameter space you get isolated bands. So for example, this is the gap between the two conduction bands, and this is the gap between the conduction and the valence band. Okay, so the action will occur when the chemical potential is in this conduction band C1.
So what do you do to incorporate the relaxation?
So very similar to what we did before, you reduce this W0. Uh-huh. And we get, you know, from Tim's group, we have some rough idea of what this W0 might be. So it's not a very sophisticated calculation right now, but that helps you get the gaps. Okay, so for example, in this picture, you can see that this white is actually the absence of a band gap. If you had no displacement field, then the conduction and valence bands would overlap. And you don't expect to see correlated phenomena in that regime if you didn't have this displacement field. Okay, so let's see what is seen in the experiment. So Philip did these, Philip and his collaborators did this experiment where they can tune both the filling and this displacement field. So filling is along this direction and displacement field is in that, filling is in this direction and displacement field is in this diagonal direction. And what they see is that this is this conduction band that I was talking about. This is the band gap, completely filled, completely empty. And with the appropriately chosen displacement field, so this turns out to be the zero displacement field. There is no band gap over here. Once you end up getting these isolated bands in a certain regime, you also see this correlated, not insulated, half filling.
In your model, is it clear? It seems like it's almost exact same displacement field we also see in our case. The correlated and the insulator neutrality happen.
That is surprising.
No, understand that?
No. It's you would have probably expected it to be somewhat displaced.
We also see the same. Is this coincidence or is this?
That's only on one side. On the other side.
On the side where it happens. It happens at the.
Well, I think he's saying.
The dark red starts at the same displacement field.
In this direction. But not in that.
No, in that one too.
And also, in fact, the sample with the superconductivity up here is actually, they are not well aligned either. So I don't know whether we can make the general statement.
Yeah, we are at a much more primitive level of understanding, I think, that would be really amazing if you could answer that. Okay, so we have some sort of regime where these bands are isolated, and we'd like to suggest that those correspond to these regions where you have isolated bands, and some subset of that corresponds to this correlated insulator.
Sorry, the color scale here is showing the band gap?
Bandwidth. This is the bandwidth.
That's the bandwidth.
Yeah, it should be milli electron volts. Yeah.
So it's the dark red is a broader band.
Yeah. Okay. So these are things, those fine details we are not very, don't work perfectly.
That actually smaller and smaller angle just continuously decreases the bandwidth.
Yes. Of course, it also decreases interactions to some extent, but this is a quicker decrease. Sorry.
The model increased trigonal warping.
Yes, and some lattice relaxation, which we put in by hand. Okay, we're still having some issues, embarrassingly, to convert this into the experimental displacements, but we'll hopefully get that sorted out.
So it seems like we fixed the theta and increase in D, there's a topological phase transition, is that right?
Yes, if you take this band, this model literally, there's a difference in the value term number as you go across this line.
So has it been seen experimentally?
No. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, you're going to see, if you see a correlated insulator at half, you want to see a closing and opening over here?
Yeah, right, precisely.
Good question, actually. That's not been, that requires us to make a more careful map. Mapping these things.
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
No, he's saying that if you go through like this, your valley churn number changes from 2 to 0. So you should see a band closing and opening over here. Which is, that makes sense. But it's not been seen as far as I know. Okay, so what is the nature of this correlated insulator that is seen? You could have two pictures. Maybe there's a tight binding model where you have spins. Now, the spin is, in addition to the electron spin, you also have valley spin. It's like an SU4 sort of Hubbard model. That could be one picture. The other one is making this analogy to lambda levels. It's kind of like you have these four bands, the electron spin up, down, and the two valleys, right and left, and you have to fill half of them. Okay, and that's the kind of problem that appears when you look at graphene's lambda levels in a magnetic field when you have this this degeneracy. Okay, so we'll think of a very simple-minded picture in this, following this kind of reasoning. Think of a Hartree-Fock theory with a uniform order. So you can think of bilinears of the electrons with the right and left being the valley and the spin sigma, sigma prime. So that's four indices for each of these operators, 16 in all. You can break them into 1 and 15, and these 15 over here are broken symmetry states. And that's the set of broken symmetry states that you can investigate. And let me give you some representative versions of this. There's the ferromagnet, where you pick both right and left valley, and you fill it with up spins. There's the valley-ordered state, where you take both spins up and down, but you fill them both in, let's say, the right valley. Okay, the valley-ordered state. You can also have the intervalley coherent state, which you can't really draw in this kind of picture. There's a condensate between the right and the left valley, essentially something that breaks translation symmetry at the microscopic graphene scale. Okay, it could be spin singlet or spin triplet. That's another set of orders. Okay, so we'd like to know the first gross feature you would like to understand is which of these three types of orders will win. Okay, and you can try to answer that within a Hartree-Fock.
The breaking up 1 plus 15, this is assuming which particular symmetries? I assume some of them are approximate, some exact.
Yeah, that's a good question. So the 1 plus 15, the zeroth order way of saying this is the 1 is simply the total charge density, this diagonal part. So of course, you take that out, the remaining 15 will represent some broken symmetry. If you had SU4 symmetry, in the problem, complete rotation symmetry between the spin and the valleys and everything, then the 15 would be degenerate. You don't have that. You don't have that because the valleys have different wave functions. Unlike in the quantum Hall problem where, all the lambda levels have the same wave function, the valleys are related by time reversal symmetry, so they have different wave functions. So the wave functions are different. The dispersion will also break that. So you never really have SU4. The best you can have is SO4. So you do independent spin rotations in the two valleys, SU2 times SU2. And if you do that, then this ferromagnet is, it turns out that there are six components in the ferromagnetic order parameter, the right valley ferromagnet and the left valley ferromagnet. This is a unique order. This has the remaining 15 minus 7, 8 of those orders are of this kind. Singlet and triplet intervalley coherent are degenerate. Because it's a U1 kind of order parameter, there's an X and Y component. Okay, so we'd like to, get a splitting between these. You can do that in Hartree-Fock. But instead of talking about that, that calculation, let me ask a simpler question is, suppose these were the three options that were available to you experimentally. How would you tell the difference? Okay, and we can go back and look at the experiments. So one thing you could imagine doing is applying a Zeeman field. Okay, apply a field that only couples to the spin, not to the orbital part, that will separate out these levels that will give you an increased gap for the ferromagnet, okay, which you wouldn't get for these other orders. And that would be, at least if you want to distinguish between these, that would be a signature of the ferromagnet.
Eight minutes.
Okay. Yeah.
That's being very generous.
I'll try to stick to that. Yeah, so this is exactly what Phillips saw. They put on an in-plane magnetic field, and it turns out that the gap increases with the field, and the increase is roughly with G equal to 2, what you would expect from the Zeeman kind of coupling. It turns out, yeah.
Why is it initially even decreases a little bit, and then flat or decreases?
Yeah, you know, this is obtained from fitting to transport data, right? That exponential and thing. So, yeah, I would not push it too much.
The activation gaps.
Yeah, right.
But do you have error bars in these?
Do I have error bars?
Pretty good. And if it's generated too, it deviates. And what's the
I think the main thing to say is it's kind of along this line.
I think the bigger question is it linear or is it parabolic?
I think in there over, I think you don't want to
say. Yeah, G equal to 2, you know, that's roughly the right number. In Pablo's experiment, this thing goes the other way around.
Right? That's 3 MeV determined by activation, by radius.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so this is the hard, there are actually two samples. This is the one with a slightly bigger angle, which has a bigger gap, the 30 Kelvin gap. There's another one where you'll see superconductivity, which is a smaller gap. Okay, now it turns out there's a caveat in this interpretation, which is the if you put a magnetic field in plane, it's not purely Zeeman. It also has some orbital effect because the layers are separated by some distance. Okay, and you can ignore that, but it turns out that can be comparable to the Zeeman field. Except it doesn't affect the top and the bottom of the dispersion, okay, because of rotation symmetry, so it's not going to change the gaps unless something weird happens, you know, unless the rest of the band comes up or something like that. If it's, you're just looking at the band gap between the top and bottom of the band, it's not going to move that. Okay, so this doesn't affect this particular interpretation, but it'll appear later.
Ashwin, why is it G denormalized? It's a strongly interacting system, right? Why is G turning up to be 2?
It's
agreement is amazing. I mean, I'm not worried.
No, it's got SU2 symmetry. It's very little spin orbit coupling.
I see.
Yeah, you don't expect G to be denormalized.
So
or did you mean by interactions?
Yeah, by interactions. Yeah.
Shankar.
I was actually talking about Coulomb interaction itself.
Yeah.
I was talking about not spin orbit, Coulomb interaction itself, which in Hartree-Fock is not included. I understand that. Hartree-Fock is not included, but it's there.
So let's have spin rotation.
So that's really a quasi particle gap.
Mm-hmm.
And it is affected by electron electron interactions. Not like
not in the Hartree-Fock theory, but it's affected in general.
Hartree-Fock. No,
Hartree-Fock used bare G.
A lot by
and you know it's seen in
no Hartree-Fock theory doesn't give the bare G. It gives will give a very large G. And
yeah, because we see that in like Tully system, right?
But maybe not for the dependence on in-plane field.
Yeah, yeah. For the Zeeman field, it shouldn't. Yeah.
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 Anyway.
Okay. So this. Of course, the really amazing observation was the superconductivity in a different device where. Actually, the Mott insulator is somewhat weaker, but you see this superconducting trace, and for example, in this white region over here. And that effect is, of course, killed by a magnetic field. And the question you could ask is, yeah.
In the previous slide, do you know why the effluent filling on the holes, there's no, or also charge neutrality, there's no monotonicity? I mean, it looks quite different at full filling and charge neutrality from the other device, right?
I think it's probably two layers that are quite different, upper layer and the bottom layer, so there are substantial disorder difference. So generally, I don't expect that it's a symmetric in terms of the different positive and negative D.
Oh, you mean like between this and that side?
Yeah. But also for the full filling, for the gap at full filling of the superlattice, right? At minus NS.
Oh. Yeah.
From here and there.
No. That's an internality. The other
the band insulator to the lower limit.
The band insulator to the lower.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to comment. The contact on the left side is very bad on this device. So we don't have a certain contact gain to the top layer. So that side have a significant pin junction in. So that's why this specific one, the left side, doesn't show proper signals.
Okay.
I think we should give remaining 4 minutes to the questions
Ashwin
can answer.
Yes. this is why I'm not an experimental.
We can continue that after. So the
key observation over here that gives us some insight into this superconducting state. Well, first of all, if you believe that it's a ferromagnet, and you dope it, you expect this ferromagnetism to survive to some doping. In which case, you'd have spin split Fermi surfaces. You have Fermi surfaces look like this. This red and blue are the opposite spin species. And it's hard to imagine that you'll get pairing between opposite spins. Okay, it's much more likely that the spins will pair along the same direction. So upspin will pair to upspin. You know, usually that is disfavored because there's no symmetry between the upspin and the upspin on some other K point. But here you have valley symmetry. Yeah, and there's very little spin-orbit coupling. So the spin-up in one valley is roughly degenerate to spin-up in the opposite valley. That plays the role of some kind of pseudo-spin, and you can have opposite pseudo-spin pairing, but equal spin pairing. Okay, so there's a very clear experimental signature expected if you have this equal spin pairing, which is if you apply a magnetic field, you should see a linear change in the transition temperature. Okay, and this linear change could be of either sign. In particular, you could end up getting an enhancement of the superconducting transition temperature by applying a magnetic field, okay, which is, of course, a very unusual thing to happen here.
I just want to understand one thing. If you just do very simple-minded S-wave superconductivity and you coexist with ferromagnetism, you only get a triplet component if the superconduction state is not homogeneous because it couples with the gradients in the Hinsburg-Landau. Here, are you saying that maybe because of the structure of the valleys, even if you have a uniform superconducting state with uniform magnetism, you will necessarily induce a triplet, or the triplet is not?
This is your starting point. This is what your Fermi surfaces are going to look like. It's an itinerant ferromagnet. So how are you going to, you want to pair this upspin with the downspin with energy scale, which is like a tenth of
Fermi
energy?
So you're in a limit where this is large enough that you...
Yeah, weak pairing. Pairing is always weak, yeah.
Yes. So just to clarify, so in your picture, what is the amount of spin polarization in the Mohr state and in the Schnecking state? Are they fully polarized?
Mohr state is fully polarized, yes. In the other, this is one of the things we'd really love to know as a function of doping, what is the polarization? How do you do that? Right? It's not clear how you do that. If you can get quantum oscillations, you can look at the Fermi C and you could tell. But right now we can't tell that. We don't even know where it ends. So, yeah.
So that expression you've written for TC of B,
I've not gotten to that yet.
Oh.
You mean this one here?
No. Sorry,
okay, just that. All right.
This one. Linear part. Uh-huh. So first of all, that's an absolute value of B?
Yeah.
Okay, so that part confuses me.
I'll get to that. I'll get to an explanation of that. Just give me a second. Yeah.
So what's the spin symmetry doing? So before, actually, we have SU to left, SU to right, and now we have U1 left, U1 right. Is that right? Or?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, in fact, there's always Hund's, so it'll SU2 left times SU right.
So the housing's already taken into account.
Yeah. It's a ferromagnet. Yeah. Right. So otherwise, the ferromagnet, you can have different spin rotation, different directional spin of the two valley. Okay. So there's a good question about the dependence on the magnetic field. Okay. So I can give you a very simple-minded theory where you can see where you get the linear dependence on field. So let's say you write down a Landau theory for a spin triplet superconductor. A spin triplet superconductor has this form of the pairing function. It has the vector d dot sigma times the antisymmetric tensor. And in general, this vector is actually a complex vector. Okay, so you could break it up, if you like, into two real components, which could be orthogonal to one another. Okay, so that's the most general pairing form you have. And let me take these two vectors to be along the x and y direction. And if you work out what this means, it basically tells you that this is a projection operator onto upspin. Okay, so this is the form of pairing if just the upspins pair. Okay, the way you would write it down in this theory is you would write it with two vectors that are orthogonal to one another. Okay, and the two vectors are, if you have along the z direction, two vectors would be x and y. Okay, so with this kind of order parameter, with these two real and imaginary components, you can write down a Landau free energy. Of course, there's the usual d squared kind of term, which will onset at Tc. But you can add another term, which is allowed, which is the cross product of these two times the magnetization. Okay, that's allowed in the Landau theory. You have a question about that?
So this still does not answer my question. So I understand how, if you have a spontaneous breaking of, if you have a triplet superconductor that's non-unitary, that's what D2 star non-zero, then it'll couple linearly to a Zeeman field and you'll get a cusp in Tc.
Yes.
However, if you were already in a ferromagnetic state before you got to superconductivity, then the leading variation would be linear in B, not the absolute value of B.
So
there's already some effective B ambient from the normal state.
Yeah, so you can think of this M as having two parts. I actually didn't write this. There is a background M, which is the ambient magnetization, mm-hmm. M naught. And then if you add a magnetic field, that magnetization will change. Okay, we're not thinking of a fully polarized system. So there are two species, and they will change.
There'll be some differential susceptibility.
There'll be some susceptibility, chi times B. And that's the part that we're interested in, because that's the thing that will change in the field. And that term, you put it in over here, you'll get something that's modulus of B.
I disagree. You talk offline.
Well,
if the coercive field is zero, then I think it should be less B.
Yeah, the coercive field is zero because of very good spin rotation symmetric.
So, quick comment.
Yeah.
When people study these spin polarized methods on the external field, tunneling experiments will show a split of the quasi-particle peak. Mm-hmm. This could be something.
All right. I have to end over here. Yeah, so we can also understand the way why it comes back. It has to do with this orbital effect. And this is just to show the same effect is seen in helium-3, which is also an equal spin pairing superfluid. Okay, so I had some speculations about the mechanism, but let me just go to my conclusions. And I think this is sort of the really nice opportunity we have with these materials. The main central questions that we have in solid-state physics, for example, when do you get a ferromagnet? Say this is a ferromagnet. When do electronic correlations give you a ferromagnet versus an antiferromagnet? How do you get these correlated superconductors? And the big variety of materials we have in these Moiré materials really gives us an opportunity to address those questions. Okay, so maybe I'll stop over here.
I have a question on the first part. So with the select elliptic function model, what happens if you had a B field?
You mean like an orbital B field?
Yeah.
We have not tried that. It's a good question. If I were to speculate. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. Yeah. So two theta functions. Yeah, it would be interesting.
The second part, is it the ferromagnetic transition, is it first order or second order? Because when DC depends on the density and you have a very high compressible electronic system, it may become first order.
Can you just repeat the question?
I'm saying, using lambda, this for lambda, what you said, if DC for the ferromagnetic case depends on the electronic density, then you have a highly compressible system with a high density of states. The
superconducting transition?
No,
ferromagnetic transition.
It looks like a crossover, right?
In fact, strictly speaking,
there's no
hysteresis. Yes, well, hysteresis is slightly different. So it depends on the anisotropy. So, if you have perfect spin rotation symmetry, you don't expect a transition in two dimensions. So then you have to live off the anisotropies and spin orbit. That's an interesting question, but we have no idea.
One last question. Yes, Ivar.
So you kind of argued that for smaller angles, you suppress this W naught, and that makes your model more appropriate. So but the experimental bound structure is asymmetric between particles and poles, while yours is always symmetric, right? So how do you?
Yeah. So the main reason for the asymmetry is this presence of the W naught. So as long as it's non-zero, you'll get some asymmetry. There's another effect, which is the rotation of the two. The fact that you have rotated by theta and minus theta, that rotation is not important if you switch off W naught. But once you have W naught, that gives you an additional particle of symmetric break.
So with W naught, you usually see roughly, or is there?
Yeah. If you add W naught, which is not all the way to one, you can. I think that's what Liang and Kushino did. They have a model where you can try to fit it, and I think it fits reasonably well.
Right. I know there are more questions, but you can interrogate him, letting other people go first. So let's thank all of you.